South African teacher turned jazz pianist Andile Yanana with Tembisa, meaning the people. It's from his acclaimed 2002 album, We Used to Dance. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it is a very cold Free Your Mind Friday. I tell you, I live in South Florida, as you know, and the iguanas are falling out of the trees. It's so cold here. And when the temperature goes down that low, they kind of become paralyzed. They freeze up, literally, and don't move. And you see people grabbing them by the tails and moving them into a warmer space where they can revive themselves. But the fear is that maybe several of them, many of them, would be not just be put into that catatonic state by the weather. The fear is that they may freeze. So, but it is an indication of how cold it is in beautiful, sunny Florida. It is not plain. And I'm hearing from my friends back in New York, it is quite a cold spell that you're going through, as much of the eastern seaboard is. But there's a little bit of warmth to be had. Look at it on the sunny side of things. On Free Your Mind Friday, you can warm up to some really hot ideas and information and opinions, people telling it as it is on 888-874-4888. It can enjoy the warmth of our very first Free Your Mind Friday for the new year. 888-874-4888. Let's hear what's on your mind and enjoy the warmth of being in the same space, as it were, with each other. Joel from New York starts us off today.
Good afternoon, Eutrice. How are you?
Okay. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Trying to stay warm. I hope you're well.
I'm hanging in. We all are. So what's on your mind today?
Well, I'd like to talk about a PBS program that I watched, the much-renowned Ken Burns and Lou Novak, the series on Vietnam. It was an 18-part program. And I had been very hesitant to watch it. Friends of mine had asked me to watch it, but I was very hesitant because I had experienced many of their previous documentaries. But I decided to watch. You know, I'm kind of curious as to how Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, who's his, makes all of the films with him, she's his archivist, how they became the sort of semi-official film documentarians of U.S. history. It's a kind of interesting question how that happened. And it seems that part of the answer lay in the way they managed to whitewash the criminal record of U.S. imperialism. And an example of this came in about 10 years ago in their, I don't know if you saw it, their PBS documentary on World War II, where they retransmitted the myth that Harry Truman atom bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, killing 146,000 Japanese civilians to save lives. And they ignored the compelling primary source evidence and historical literature showing that top U.S. military and intelligence leaders understood that Japan was defeated and seeking surrender at the end of World War II, and that the atom bomb crimes were perpetrated to demonstrate unassailable U.S. power to the world, and especially to the Soviet Union in the post-World War II era. That's really a resolved historical question for over 20 years now, and they ignored it. And then along the way, in this documentary, they accepted without comment the notion that the Philippine Commonwealth, which was, as you know, seized and suppressed with massive bloody force by the U.S. during and after the Spanish-American War at the turn of the 20th century, belonged rightfully to the U.S. before it was attacked by the Japanese in 1941. And they also pretended that Washington had no reason to expect the Pearl Harbor assault, even though the U.S. had been waging crippling economic war in Tokyo for many years. So I finally came around to watching their vaunted series on Vietnam. And I have to tell you, the reason why it was so deflating watching this is because the theme of this series was that it was a civil war, that it wasn't really a people's war against a foreign invasion. And I tell you, Uchis, I just can't hear anymore. And that the tragedy of the war was that America made mistakes in Vietnam. And I just can't hear any more laments about America's mistakes in Vietnam. It drives me up the wall. It's like hearing people weep because the Nazis screwed up by attacking the Soviet Union before taking out England. It's not my cup of moral tea. And so without going into, you know, any detail, because people can watch it for themselves and make their own conclusions, a very, very simple truth seems to be buried in the millions of dollars that they invested in making this filmmaking rubble. And I have a number of questions that immediately came to mind as I watched this hour after hour. Did the Vietnamese troops invade the United States? Did the Vietnamese Air Force spend years spraying millions of tons of Agent Orange onto forests and crops in California and Ohio? Are there pictures of naked girls fried with napalm in Alabama that we haven't seen? Were hundreds of thousands of civilians in Canada and Mexico killed to pursue Vietnamese military objectives in the U.S.? Did the Vietnamese troops massacre women, old people, and babies and dump their bodies into mass graves in Missouri or Montana or Michigan? United States government invaded Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, not the other way around. And before that, the U.S. provided financial and military support to the French war to keep Vietnam a colony. And any suggestion that the U.S. was somehow the victim of the war, of a civil war, is not just wrong. It's just another example of the moral confusion for which our nation pays a greater price than we are willing to admit. So, and by the way, the film was, the documentary was funded by a wide variety of corporate sponsors, but the main corporate sponsors, wait for this, were Bank of America and David Koch. And I think any self-respecting person who would really want to look at the truth will be very wary about taking money from those sources.
Thank you for that considered opinion. You got us started today. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Stay warm.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Jeremiah from Harlem, you're on the air.
Hi, pleasure to speak with you today, Patrice.
Thank you.
I just wanted
to make
a general thank you. Happy New Year. I wanted to make a general observation that I've noticed. I don't know when I made this observation exactly, but I just noticed that people in general, wherever you fall on the political spectrum, have a sort of split personality, which is we really care about people, surprisingly and suddenly and for some reason, in some intervals. But then in other situations, when you present to people human abuse, violence against human beings, if it falls outside of your political agenda, basically, all of a sudden you're not so sensitive anymore. And this applies to all of us. It applies to me as well. I remember when those congressmen were shot at the congressional baseball game. First of all, most people I knew were surprised that there even was a congressional baseball game. It's like, really? Those guys are in good enough shape to run around and chase a baseball? But, yeah, that was surprising. That was the first reaction. But then it was like, wow, there was this shooting. And, and immediately people made a lot of sarcastic jokes. Like, oh, bet you want your gun control now, don't you? And, I'm not one to necessarily preach love thy enemy. But I think we should really avoid crossing into that line where we don't realize it, but we have been dehumanized as well. I think it is ironic if you were in favor of gun ownership rights and opposed to gun control and then you get shot. But I'm not going to make a joke about it. And, I find the same thing, a fundamental contradiction, is when you come across people who are Black Lives Matter activists, which I am one, but then who are also adamant Obama supporters. And when we try to get into the discussion about Libya and the fact that the Obama administration was, you know, supporting policies or carrying out policies that were highly destructive to Libya, and now we have chattel slavery, I find most people cannot even cognitively have that discussion as adults. They start saying, oh, well, there's always been slavery. And all, hey, that's not really a responsible response when you supported a political agenda, and now we have this kind of horrible outcome in an African country, and people just cannot even cognitively address the matter. And I just wish we could all operate from a more genuine point of adamantly caring about human life and human dignity. And those are my comments for this Friday.
Well, and great and sober comments they are. But this is the continuing conundrum that we have in the political world, isn't it? That people espouse a particular philosophy or feeling or idea, and then they come smack dab up against the opposite of what it is they're talking about, and they can't move. And then they get angry because they're confronted with the contradiction. What you're saying is that, and it's a point well taken, we have to try very hard to become mature in the business of examining issues and dealing with each other, especially when we disagree. Thanks so much for that. A very sober piece of advice. Thanks so much.
Thank
from
you.
Chicago, Henry, you're there.
Hey, Trace, how's it going?
Okay, Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, too. Coming back, my family and I just came back from the Philippines, where it's not cold. So coming here to the States was a little bit of a climate shock to us. But it was the reason why I called is because I want to give a little report from my Filipino trip that I had. One of the things that I was really curious about, and we've talked about this before, about President Duterte. So I kind of asked around, you know, about how they felt about him, and I kind of got a sense that they generally much approve of him. They understand some of the things that have been, you know, claimed about him, and even though they don't approve of it, they kind of understand what's going on in their sense. To give you a general sense of how I kind of did this, my mother, who's Filipino, their family lives in northern Luzon. It's the northern part of the Philippine Islands. So generally the people in that area kind of, you know, they kind of approved of Duterte, where I think most of the Duterte detractors in the Philippines are from the Metro Manila area. Which is the capital of the Philippines and the largest city of the Philippines. I think the outlying areas are the ones that kind of approve of him. So when I asked about the killings, the extrajudicial killings that he is kind of approving, most of them don't approve of that neither, but they also understand that since there have been so much corruption in the Philippines, especially with the municipal police, because the problem was that the municipal police was the one in on the drug trade. And so I was like, kind of sounds similar to what's going on here in the States, where the Chicago PD, New York PD, and LAPD, and all these other PDs in these cities are part of the drug trade as well. So I guess the Duterte just figured he wasn't going to try to, do anything about these particular municipalities of police. So he just went on just basically encouraged people to just kill, you know, the drug pushers. But, you know, most people don't approve of that part of it. But other than that, they actually approve of him, trying to improve the economy, trying to improve other things like the infrastructure and, yeah, they don't like, you know, they don't basically kind of worship, you know, him, but they have a genuine sense that he is, you know, generally trying to improve the situation in the Philippines. I don't know what it is with people on the outside. Well, one thing that I have noticed, too, is that Duterte is the first Filipino president from the area of Mindanao, which is the southern part of the Philippines. And Mindanao is where most of the dark-skinned Filipinos are from. So I don't know if it was, I don't know if it's just that, you know, that, that kind of bugs, you know, Western nations about him. But, you know, I was just trying to, you know, trying to just get a gauge on it. And I know, like, you know, the short time I was there, I can't fully, you know, get the scoop on it. But, you know, from what I've understand, you know, just asking from my family, from friends in the Philippines who live there on the situation, you know, in the Philippines, as far as the president is concerned, it's something that was, you know, pretty interesting.
Well, it's more than interesting. Here's an issue. I admire that you made the effort to ask people what they're thinking, and that you determined there's a split view of this. But there's no question, or should I say, there, to your mind, is there a question about the validity, the constitutionality of what Duterte has undertaken in terms of these extrajudicial killings, authorizing the police and civilians to kill people on site if they believe them to be engaging in drug sales or drug activity? I mean, that's lawlessness, isn't it?
That is true. However, this is an interesting thing that I found out in the Philippines is that their constitution is one of the largest or the largest constitutions in a republic. And I don't know how many pages, but they say compared to other countries who have a constitution, it is very, very, very long. So I don't know.
But would a constitution justify extrajudicial killings, which he has time and again announced the appropriateness of it? He has encouraged people to do away with fellow citizens and make a summary judgment and become, you know, the prosecutor and executioner and jury all at the same time. This is a very troubling matter. And the countries of the world are alarmed by Duterte's approach to, quote, law and order, unquote.
Yeah, and that is true. However, like I said, I kind of got a sense that, you know, they were, you know, like, they weren't, like I said, they weren't enamored with it, but they kind of got a sense that they understand why, because, drug use has been a very unfortunate corruption along with the politics that has gone on in the Philippines as well. And that is another thing that, you know, like I said, from the few people I talked to, that Duterte is, how do we term it here? Cleaning the swamp over there. So they really admire his way of cleaning the politics of that place. But like I said, I didn't get approval from the extrajudicial killings of it, and they were kind of like, you know, not approving of that. Yeah, I don't know about the constitutionality of it because it's a big constitution. So
there is no constitutionality of it anywhere in the world, I would think, where it is okay for, you know, your neighbor to say, well, I had to shoot him because I saw him smoking a joint or shooting up cocaine. So the constitutionality of it, people are raising these, to me, irrelevant questions with regard to whether these extrajudicial killings are okay within the context of a constitution. I can't imagine a place on the planet where a constitution would say, yeah, it's okay to do. I mean, the man is so driven by this. He's even said publicly, you might have heard, that he would kill his own son. And he gave permission to people to kill his own children if they should find them, engaging in drug sales and other drug activity. So this is a major issue. I got from you the sense that the country is trying to cope with coming out of a succession of years under, we know about the previous Filipino leaders, but akin to what China experienced during the Opium Wars, the British basically saturating or endeavoring to saturate China with the drug in order to conquer it. People have that parallel comparison going, but it is a country that is dealing with a lot of internal turmoil left by, the previous administrations, the culture of corruption, the fact that it is saddled with a burden of being a narco state. And this is the same thing that's going on all over the world that had become narco states. How do you deal with that? Is there a humane way to deal with that?
Yeah. And, one last thing, Eutrace, and this is the one thing that kind of hurt me a little bit in regards to the psychology of the media there. And, it's happening all over the world. It happens here a lot. But the preference of beauty of light-skinned Filipino people, and it was like I saw it on their TVs. It was just nothing but, light-skinned Filipinos who were propped up as these great people. They had a big billboard in the city I was staying in Lawag, and also in Metro Manila as well, where they had these big advertisements of soap, white skin whiteners that they promote. And it was, it just hit me there how a non-white country is still dealing with white supremacy, and dealing with, the previous colonialism that they had under, the Spanish and the United States in regards to, the saying of, white is right. And if you never visited the Philippines and you just saw it on TV, you'd never think that there were dark-skinned Filipinos there. That kind of irked me a little bit because I was like, wow,
Well, don't forget also it's been reinforced by a succession of colonial powers invading that part of the world. And so these ideas took hold because they stayed there for quite a while. And the impact of their presence and the invasion and the subsequent dealings with the country still reinforce the idea of white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks so much. I'm glad that you're back. And how are you dealing with the cold there in Chicago?
Oh, God. It was like... it was like 30 when we first got here. And because I was like, when we left Manila, it was like about 83.
I know. And back to the old icebox. Good to hear from you today, Henry. Thank you. Tag from New York, you're on the air.
Peace, Sister Eutrace.
Thank you. To you too.
Much appreciated. And I just, want to just send the shouts that are merited out to you for, upholding this concept of, moral integrity within journalism, within just communication in general, in essentially a vacuum in that regard. So, just much appreciated for that.
Thank you so much.
I know there's much mind to free out here today, so I'll try and keep it concise. I just wanted to share with you and with the listeners an event coming up in the city this coming Tuesday that, in fact, connects exactly to the previous caller's call and what y'all were discussing around, you know, this toxic skin bleaching and, you know, the global implications of prison slavery and the drug war and white supremacy, which is the focus of this event. So again, that's this coming Tuesday, the 9th, and it will be at the CUNY Graduate Center, which is at 365 Fifth Avenue. And the focus, again, is on white supremacy. It's a dialogue on white supremacy featuring MOVE's Ramona Africa, as well as the historian Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. And so it promises to be, you know, extremely dynamic, and just it's an important moment right now for such dialogues, particularly from, you know, women such as these who have lived, you know, through so much and, you know, do so much around this question of racism, white supremacy. So again, that's a dialogue on white supremacy. It's the second installment of Inside the Activist Studio, which is an effort by the Campaign to Bring Mumia Home to really just promote a culture of resistance out here.
Well, thank you. Thanks for that information. And I hope you get a good turnout, and that in any event, it's the work that I'm responding to, the idea that people have not given up at all, that they continue to do the work. And this is quite impressive. Thank you, Tag, for calling in today.
Absolutely.
Ali from New York, you're on the air.
Hi, Idris. How are you doing today?
I'm okay. How about you?
Well, you know, that is pretty cold there. It's pretty cold here right now.
Well, I know, but you know what? It's quite a sight. You just never get accustomed to iguanas falling out of the trees. And we've had quite a few, of iguanas falling out of the trees here. So what's on your mind today?
Okay. The first thing that I had to say, I just going to ask you a question because you were having a conversation, and I don't remember if it was at the beginning of the week or at the end of last week, that you were having a conversation about Blacks and Latinos not being united, and you were talking about the law department, that there is no people of color, hardly anyone, and they make the law for the city. Do you remember that conversation?
Yes.
You were having it with one of the male callers that calls all the time. So I just wanted to tell you something, and I'm going to try to be as short as possible, or something that I had experienced. And when I tell you this story, I just wanted to say I'm not defending Latinos, because I was one of those people who actually went to East Harlem, to El Barrio, to actually have a protest against Melissa Viverito when she was having this meeting, this open forum, when she was trying to sell El Barrio, which she did. She was just lying, and we knew it because of some of the groups that I belong to. So, but I will have to say this. Some years ago, I was participating with a group here called Stop Mass Incarceration, and we were working very hard on a stop and frisk and also on police brutality. So they needed somebody to go to one of the African-American churches here. This church, I'm not going to name it, but it's on, I believe, in Covenant Avenue here in Manhattan on 145th Street. It's a very nice church, a very big church, and they needed somebody to go there. I was not the person that they pointed out, but then the person couldn't go, so I volunteered and I went there. I just wanted to tell you that the African-American churches, they have been very powerful in the African-American community. But what I experienced there, it was something that it just left my mouth open. On that day, the minister from different churches, they meet once a month, I think it is. And I went there to endorse one of our big protests in the city, which it was pretty big, that one. So we wanted the endorsement and some of them to participate. So when I got there, and the reason that I'm telling you this story is because this is how I noticed that not even African-Americans are united, especially people that they are ministers. And this is what it surprised me the most. I'm not surprised about the Latino because I don't like to vote for Latinos. But this is what happened. So when I got there, the first thing that I noticed, they have a hierarchy. That's how they conduct this meeting. And because I want them to endorse this, they took me to a back room with another gentleman because we have to put down the information that we were getting ready to introduce to these ministers. I will have to tell you, and before they took me to back room, I was there for a very long time listening to all this presentation and all of them. There was one African-American woman, and she is a minister. She made a derogatory statement about immigrants, about especially Latinos. She knew that I was in there because even though I'm a black woman, and I just wanted to tell Henry that a lot of the Filipinos think that I'm Filipino, but I guess I would be a dark Filipino. Just wanted to tell you that she knew I was there. She made this derogatory statement about Latinos, okay, about immigrants in this city. I just didn't say anything because I went there just for a purpose to for them to endorse this call. So then I went back into the back room, can I tell you, what surprised me was how professional is how they were acting. Like, you know, if you are not at this level, you can't speak now. You have to wait for the next person and the next person. So I was one of the last ones. My point to you with this is, those people, those ministers, they can't relate to lower people. You know what the big thing on that day was? That Cy Vance had invited them to a breakfast in the morning the next day. And all of them, they were getting ready to go to this breakfast. My point about that conversation that you were having is that the African-American community is not together. How anybody expect for them to enjoy all the group to be together with them? Because what I saw there, that these people, they felt like they're in a different level than the people that they're serving. And that's what it surprised me the most.
But I don't doubt that this happened at all. I'm kind of wondering. I mean, you've been in the field of community activism for years. Why does it surprise you?
It surprised me because when I went there and this group wanted me to go there so that I could make it, they could make an endorsement about this, I had never been around so many African-American. The only person that it was not African-American on that day was me. I was the only one. But what it surprised me is the level that, you see, when these people, you see them mingling in those churches with the, what you call parishioner, or what you call them, you think that they are almost at the same level. But when you see them separate, all of them as a group, they think that the hierarchy is so big that it got a stun on me. You understand what I'm saying? That's what it's
surprising. Oh, yes, I understand exactly what you're saying. But this is part of the reality of life as a political activist. You get to see up close what many, many people don't get to see. I mean, I could tell you stories that would blow your mind about the conduct of the so-called leaders in the African-American church community. It's outrageous. But the churches, there's a reason they call them the princes of the church. A pastor who is the head pastor of a church occupies a position that has had for a long, long time a great deal of not just power and authority, but influence. Churches have become politicized in ways that we could never have imagined. And they are useful to the power structure because it is expected that they would be the touchstones for the communities they're located in. Is the church a church? I don't want to name it, but is it on a hill? On 145th Street?
Yes. Yeah, you know which one it is. Believe me, you know that church. I don't have no doubt in my mind.
It's a church. So, I mean, it's a big deal to be the pastor of a church that big. It's amazing. But the attitudes have not been cultivated where the people are familiar with each other in the community. You would think that on that street alone, there are all kinds of churches, Pentecostal mm-hmm. churches, Baptist churches, Coptic churches, and so forth. You would think that they would have running dialogues with each other. It doesn't happen that way. That's not the way it works. Each church is an island unto itself. And if the pastor doesn't have the vision, then the church doesn't have the vision. That's why my friends and I try to join them in supporting. There's a church right down the hill, a Presbyterian church. So St. James Presbyterian, it's 120 years old. And there are many such churches in the community that are taking a different path of opening themselves up to the community and not taking this idea that the church is a bunker where people come on Sunday and then they scatter out after the service. But other than that, they have no direct ongoing contact with the community. So what you saw and what you experienced is the ignorance that goes along with that. If you isolate yourself and you insulate yourself from the community, what other kind of attitude do you expect people to have if they do not relate with each other? That's the attitude that they have. And that is why the churches in the African-American community, for the most part, are not involved in the real lives of people in those communities. They're not. Theirs is a Sunday contact, and then, you know, after service, people go home. But other than that, they don't know the community. It's a tragic thing. And what you experienced also, I've experienced it a lot. People having attitudes that this is a reflection of the degree to which we're all subjugated to white supremacy. We hate ourselves to such a degree, we can't even envision that there's a world outside the strict definition of African-American being, you know, African, Southern African-American. What is going on here? The church hasn't grown up, and that is why it is a dying institution. It hasn't grown up. It hasn't kept pace with a purpose, an evident purpose and need in the communities in which they're located. They're not an integral presence in the community. They're like little bunkers of influence and people who believe they have great influence. I referred to the church on the hill because that is the hill, Sugar Hill. And Sugar Hill was a very hoity-toity community of black folks who were doing, as they thought, better than the rest of the other black folks. So that church served such a community, and it has continued to, you know, hold on to some of these ideas that there's no need to come down from the hill. You know, it's about people having to make their way up to the hill. It's a very arcane and archaic way of thinking, but, you know, that's what you'd, I'm glad you observed it for yourself and experienced it for yourself, because you will have to steel yourself, you know, strengthen yourself as an activist. You're going to encounter this a lot. Ali, are you there? Okay, so she hung up. All right, but this is true. It is not pretty out there. And you can't take these insults and you can't take these slights personally. You actually have to turn them around and see the degree to which you have progressed. But there's so much work to do in bringing people along who present themselves as, you know, progress, the very essence of progress. They have been the ones who have been in the struggle. This is crazy. It's a crazy thing. But prepare yourself. You get that a lot. But don't let it take you down. Really don't. You're a strong person. Continue doing your good work. But understand that a lot of people long ago have abandoned what you are now doing. David from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, Yatrees.
Hello.
What's on my mind today? I have a friend from Pennsylvania, and he came to visit me this week. And we got talking about politics, and my interest was in his state of Pennsylvania. And what I want to say is that people need to get out of their mind the idea that we in any way have a democracy here, or some people say a representative democracy. That is so ridiculous. It's not even funny. I did a little research, and I looked at the state of Pennsylvania, and I see they have 13 Republican congresspeople and 5 Democratic congresspeople. And I say, that's interesting. So I did a little more research, and I found out the ones who are connected somehow to the Republican Party and also the Democratic Party. And the Republican Party had someone somewhat over 3 million odd, and the Democratic Party had over 4 million. So even though you have far many more people who are registered with this crooked Democratic Party than the crooked Republican Party, 13 of the congresspeople are Republicans and 5 are Democrats. I mean, the gerrymandering is fantastic in the Pennsylvania state. It is so crooked, and people have to get it by their heads that this is in no way a democracy.
Well, I quite agree. I mean, you could take your own neighborhood in Brooklyn that was divvied up 5 ways before Shirley Chisholm decided that she was going to run. By that time, they had split up Bedford-Stuyvesant into 5 different congressional districts.
Yes.
This is how they dilute and weaken the vote. And,
exactly.
You know, they stand up now and they talk about my district, but the district was created, you know, out of gangsterism, essentially. Let's break up this community so that there will be no consolidated political power. Yes. Especially that there could be consolidated white power within these five districts, but there's not going to be any place where you have a consolidated power of people of color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the thing that got to me, that they have 13 congresspeople, even though they represent far fewer the people. It's just amazing how they're able to gerrymand and do this. And I'm sure this is happening in other states also, and other schemes to disenfranchise certain people all over the country. So forget about this notion that you have so-called democracy because you don't have it.
What, since you raised the question, what is a workable system in terms of representation, political representation, in your mind?
Well, let's look at it this way. A workable system, I don't know about any perfect system. What I do know is the system we have here is not working. First of all, we shouldn't allow these professional politicians to stay in office. Second of all, I'd say that the idea of legal bribes called campaign contributions should be outlawed. There should be no legalized bribery system that we have now called campaign contributions. There should be none of that allowed. And then we have another way of doing things I'd say would be better than now, of the candidates being equally able to have ballot access. You wouldn't have a flood of laws in every state to keep people from getting on the ballot. That's another item. And then the next item would be a way to have each candidate from whatever party, not just the two capitalist parties of the one party with the two divisions, Republican, Democrat, and have people be able to get on the ballot and run for office. We can't continue this corrupt, destructive two-party system of one party that is ridiculous and is corrupt all the way. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So people have to get to the point where we do something different and some of those things I just suggested. And one of the big things is ballot access. Have ability to get on the ballot and run for office, and no contributions from private entities, corporations, any personal money. And we have a system of we control the airwaves, the television, radio. They're owned by the people, and everybody has an equal chance to advertise what they are proposing for the good of the people. That's a start.
But considering that the two-party system has been in place for so long, it has conditioned people quite effectively to believe that anything else is unworkable, that this is just the best way to do our politics. We have A and B. You simplify.
Yes, but we've got to break that. We can't give in and think that this is going to last forever. It has to end. It's ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense. I understand what you're saying, that people have the notion that this is a good system to maintain, but it's not. We got to end this. We have to end this two-party system. We have to do a system that is for the benefit of the people. The two-party system is for the benefit of the corporations, the plutocrats, the oligarchs that run the country. They are the ones, and we can see that by what's happening now. I mean, it's very clear that at least half the people are poor and they're poor. And that should not be the goal of the company, to enrich the few at the expense of the many. We've got to have a different system.
But haven't we also seen that independent movements have betrayed the investment made by millions of people? They're not doing what they're supposed to do. And, you know, we had Sanders, who still has not yet explained to the millions of people who voted for him what happened to their votes.
We got to move beyond that.
We have a Green Party.
We've got to drop him and move on to somebody else and move on to another movement, another area. We can't hang with Bernie Sanders, who was happy that Colonel Gaddafi was killed and murdered in Libya. I know, and he's a big war guy. No, that's out. Let's get on to somebody else. You know,
maybe that's true. But we still have to have, I think, we still have to have, I hate to use the word, but closure with both Sanders and Stein of the Green Party about how they handled this investment and essentially act as if, well, we're beyond that now. We should look forward and not get stuck analyzing and getting into the nitty-gritty of how poorly they handled the investments that millions of people have placed into their hands. Thanks, David, for your call today. And that brings us to the end of our program. I'm so glad that we were able to warm up with each other today. There are a couple of things that I want to try in this new year, and that is to revive the business of our listener lectures. And I'm looking forward to getting listeners to do the presentations themselves on a particular subject, but I'll give you more details on that. I want to do this as a way of preparing us, each of us, to be able to deliver the goods anywhere and anytime to make your arguments and to inform us as well about an area you may have a particular expertise about that we could learn from. So you'll be hearing more about listener lectures in the coming weeks as we, you know, get closer to formulating how this might work. It's really not that difficult. What I want to do is to prepare you to think about the idea. If you have in your mind a subject area that you would like to deliver a lecture on, just drop me a note at leadstories@gmail.com. It worked very nicely before, but I'd like it to be revived again. So we've come to Friday, a cold weekend ahead of us. Let us kind of warm up with each other and your friends and family and give yourselves some time, some downtime, take advantage of it and get your head together. Up next is Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. You really want to listen to that. That's a great program. And you can reach me again at leadstories@gmail.com. Have yourselves a great weekend. Bye-bye.